SiriusXM Sports Bet Prime Time. What time is it? It is time to get primed, i.e., prime time. As usual, we are jam-packed wall-to-wall with topics to discuss today, John. We have Wimbledon. It is the All England Tennis Club grass court affair, really the masters of the tennis Grand Slam circuit. And we want to talk about the different ways that you can bet tennis, and there's a lot more happening there than one might think at first impression. So we're going to get into some of the detail of that and get your picks for the event. Then we want to talk about the looming NBA free agency kicks off this week, at the end of this week. So many moving pieces, whether it's the Nets, the Clippers, what's going to happen with DeAndre Ayton out west. So lots of chips that are going to fall, and we'll see where they're going to slot in and how that affects future betting for the 2023 championship odds. And things are moving around quickly. And then finally, John, we want to hit on MLB futures and how they're moving as the trade deadline is still a little ways off, but there's no shortage of anticipation and people speculating on how some of these clubs may be aggressive ahead of the deadline and start positioning themselves to look towards a championship run. The championship window is open for some teams, and they get increasingly aggressive when the window opens, don't they, John?
Do they ever, Matt? And the clubs also get a little bit... The clubs get a little intense, but the fan bases get a little antsy too, right? Like, look, you and I, we always talk about the starting pitching or the bullpen or such and such and this and left-handed bat, whatever it is. You can imagine that's happening in a number of other cities as that trade deadline approaches. They want to make their team to make a playoff run, and you're right, it's that crazy season coming up.
It is, and these deep-pocketed teams that we complain about on here, because we're not one of them currently, or we're not spending like a big market right now. But the Yankees and the Mets and, of course, the Dodgers and teams of that ilk, Houston and so on, that spend so much money and seem to have unlimited resources. And when you're thinking about positioning yourself towards the trade deadline, it's, of course, you want to add pieces that you need to fill in what are perceived to be gaps and where you can improve yourself significantly and if it's a favorable contract. So with all those considerations. But then a big one is you're keeping it away from your opponent. So if it's someone like Luis Castillo, or we'll touch on that when we get into it, but reading how that would play out for the Jays if they were to pursue him and so on. But if they acquire him, if they don't get him, guess who is? Yep. Boston, New York, you know, or Tampa Bay or whoever, someone they're competing with. So... Mm-hmm. It sort of has two major substantive impacts on your prospects for the playoffs and as a team generally. So we're going to talk about that, just MLB futures, how they're moving in advance of the trade deadline and where people sit currently and recent significant changes there. Talked about the NBA futures, and we wanted to talk about some developments just ahead of free agency, which is always fun. Lots of news yesterday that we'll get into. But then off the top, we wanted to get into Wimbledon, as we said, and talk about a little tennis betting, which I didn't really appreciate. Some of the different options as far as how to bet tennis. So we'll just do a high-level review of that and then get your thoughts on the event generally, as we said. But before we do that, we want to remind everyone, if you go to Twitter, you'll find us there at Canadian Betting. So make sure you're a follower. You can provide feedback there. You can contact us there. So that's really the base. And, of course, all of our episodes, we're getting close to 100 now, John. Can you believe that?
Unbelievable. That is exciting.
90 or so, I think. And so we're going to be looking forward to our 100th episode. But each episode is released there. If you're a follower, it'll automatically be updated to your devices. You know, most of you are podcast aficionados by this point, and that's part of the reason you're listening. So I won't explain it to you, waste everybody's time. But also remember to rate, follow, and review if you're on iTunes or whichever directory you use to access content. So do that if you can. We appreciate any feedback. And also, remember, our main platform that we're rolling on, which we call our main platform, John, is SiriusXM. Throughout the United States and Canada, our material can be accessed by our loyal audience and followers. Isn't that interesting, John?
I love it. The fact that we can actually reach those in the United States that might be interested in some of the things with the CanCon that we offer here, and the non-CanCon, frankly, is pretty interesting. And I think it's key to what they might want to do with their sort of betting pursuits in the coming weeks and months.
How about when those moronic Americans named a hockey team? They get a franchise in Anaheim, and they name it the Mighty Ducks. Was that the stupidest franchise name ever? Did it denigrate our national pastime, John?
Well, I think, you mean, it was Disney, right? They were part of their crazy sort of
thing. Yeah, so Disney's American. That's no excuse.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. They finally solved it, but I didn't like Mighty Ducks either. I'm not gonna bury them for it. But
it's almost as bad as Raptors for our Toronto Raptors. As much of a cash grab for kids and so on.
That's good. Jurassic Park. You're right. Good.
Which is worse, Raptors or Mighty Ducks?
Mighty Ducks was worse.
Is it?
Oh yeah, no question. Mighty Ducks is saying, like,
let's be real about this.
Yeah. Ducks ended up being fine, right? But Mighty Ducks is just like, they just created a movie, you know, called, what was it called? Was it called the Mighty Ducks?
Yeah.
What was it?
I think so.
Anyways, whatever. It was the Mighty Ducks, and I hated it. It was sort of a little tweak at the Canadian game. I think, what was it? Eisner was his name. He was the CEO. Mm-hmm. And I remember him. And while overtime has ended up being, or shootouts have ended up being, a good thing for the game, Matt, I remember him talking about how it's a no-brainer to have shootouts in the NHL for the NHL when it hadn't had shootouts for 70 years, right? It sort of rubbed me the wrong way. Here's a guy coming in and saying, yeah, you should have shootouts. It's a no-brainer, and we're Team Mighty Ducks and stuff like that. It just annoyed me. But anyways, water under the bridge.
It is, and I also remember having some negative feelings about the selection of Raptors at the name of the Toronto team, because it was on the heels of the Jurassic Park movies and success, and dinosaurs were incredibly trendy, and particularly with children, young children. And so it seemed really heavily focused on marketing and merchandise sales and, you know, cute logos and characters and so on, and the mascot and so on, and, you know, purple dinosaur Barney and everything. It just seemed like a ridiculous name to me at the time, and I've sort of gotten over it in time, but just not far from Mighty Ducks in terms of what seemed to be the real driving force behind the choice. To me, what do you think?
Right. Well, I recall the NBA at the time chose the Raptors name. I remember everybody was coming down. It was going to be Bobcats or Raptors. Okay, this is what would be this be 94, 95, something like that, right, Matt? And it was Bobcats or Raptors. And I remember liking Bobcats more. But so they chose Raptors, and it was an NBA-driven thing, and they had all kinds of marketing behind it, and market research, and whatever. For whatever, whoever got to choose the name in the end was Raptors. So what happened just a few years later? The Charlotte Bobcats came aboard, right? It was just saying, hey, we did all this work. Bobcats is a well-liked name. Take Bobcats. And they did take Bobcats. Again, I don't know the commerce specifically for that context, but I didn't like Raptors that much either. But whatever, it's nothing to me now, and it's just sort of the fun of saying, what, they use Bobcats and they use Raptors instead of Bobcats.
Good God, listen to this, John.
Yeah.
Just looked it up quickly, found on Bar Down. The Toronto Raptors, blah, 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 were officially awarded a franchise name back in 1993, chose their name through a fan vote contest, which I vaguely remember, called the Name Game. Brilliant. The contest generated a massive response, resulting in over 2,000 different options, which were eventually narrowed down to, you ready for some of these disasters?
Yeah.
Beavers. Bobcats. There you go. Mm-hmm. Dragons. Horrible to me. Grizzlies, of course, used shortly thereafter by the league, as you said. Hogs. Which is Hogs, John. The Toronto Hogs.
Dreadful. Hogtown, right?
Yeah. Raptors. Scorpions. Your band. That's your favorite band.
That's it. I was fine with that.
T-Rex.
Like, there you go.
Put a bullet in the middle of my forehead, John, if we're the T-Rex.
Yeah.
Tarantulas. Really gimmicky and stupid.
Oh, I think it got a lot of action, though, Matt. I think it was popular.
Good
but anyways,
Lord.
Go on. Yeah. Richmond Spiders. All right. Anyways, go on.
Terriers. That's not as horrible.
Nope.
So anyway, we can leave it there. Beavers, Bobcats, Dragons, Grizzlies, Hogs, Raptors, Scorpions, T-Rex, Tarantulas, Terriers. So Raptors doesn't look that bad in that compared to that list. What do you think?
How about if it was Scorpions? They'd come out to rock you like a hurricane every game. It'd be awesome.
Scorpions would be fine with me. That's fine. Yeah. That's definitely one of the better ones there, right? Yeah. Grizzlies is good, I guess.
I didn't mind Grizzlies. I didn't mind Bobcats and Terriers. I actually didn't mind.
Yeah.
So that Raptors would have been probably fifth on that list.
All right.
Anyways, it does nothing for me now. It's just let's just be on the right side of their games. That's what I view it as.
Yeah.
I was this youngster, as you were during that time. Now I'm a grizzled veteran.
Yeah, that's right. All right, let's get back to business. Yep. Okay, Wimbledon, it's the big one. It's the grand poppy of them all, John. So a lot of the major players dropping out. We're going to get into some of the different options to bet, but just by way of a high-level review, we saw just this morning I could still find odds on Matteo Berrettini, even though he's pulled out, announced this morning through social media. He announced that he had tested positive for COVID and he was pulling out. He's the second high-profile player to pull out of the draw within the first 2 days because of COVID. 2014 U.S. Open champion in 2017, Wimbledon finalist Marin Cilic was seeded 14th. He's out for COVID as well. Bracket is now without five of the top 11 in the ATP rankings. Number one, Daniel Medvedev, Zverev, Rublev, because of the ban on Russians in the case of Medvedev and Rublev. Ankle surgery for Zverev. Number 10, Hubert Hurkacz. How do you say that guy's name, John?
Hurkacz.
Was out on Monday, and now Berrettini, as we mentioned. So, yeah, five of the top 11 are out. Still in the draw, of course, Felix Auger-Aliassime of Canada and Denis Shapovalov of Canada as well. FAA sort of one of the dark horse but trendy picks to win it all. Maybe not dark horse isn't the right word, but hasn't won, obviously. We're looking at some of the odds and the different ways to bet, though, John. I'm sure you know you're the expert. I'm the new guy that's learning and getting up the curve on this stuff. But I didn't appreciate all of these different aspects. So, of course, I knew that you could do a futures bet on who's going to win the tournament. So that's not news to me. Mm-hmm. Apparently, I was reading you can bet up to the quarterfinals. Mm-hmm. Typically, you can make a bet on who you think's going to win. There'll be odds, 12-1, 15-1. We'll get into that in a second. For example, Felix Auger-Aliassime, FAA, sits at the book I was looking at this morning. He moved up third shortest odds to 12-1, 12 plus 1200 after Berrettini's withdrawal. So he sits behind only the Joker, Novak Djokovic, who's minus 165 to win, and Rafael Nadal at plus 500 or 5-1. So that's the futures bet angle, and we're going to get your pick, John. Then the next one, so just the money line bet on a specific match. So you just pick the winner. There's a money line ascribed to each of the two competitors. Of course, the underdog has the plus sign, and the favorite who has the higher probability of winning is the minus sign beside them usually. So you just need to pick the winner. You make the bet. We talk about the $100 unit as an easy way to describe it. So in the match with FAA, I think I saw him at minus 340. So if you hypothetically on a $100 unit, to explain it, if I bet $340 on him and he covers as the favorite, or if he wins as the favorite, rather, I would net $100, so I'd have my $340 bet return, and I would gross $440. So I put down $340, come out with $440, so I net $100. Right, John? That's generally how it works.
Simple as it is. Yep.
So that's the money line bet that you can do for any match. Of course, there's however many matches in the event, building towards the through the bracket and building towards the final. Third one is something called the set spread. So I wasn't familiar with this one. So for example, you can have a -2.5 set spread on a heavy favorite, for example, like Djokovic. So a -2.5 set spread for Joker, he would need to win. Of course, you have to win three sets to win a match. And so he would have to win 3-0, because if he won 3-1, then he didn't cover the 2.5 spread. Or if he won 3-2, then he didn't obviously cover the 2.5 spread. But if he won 3-0, then he did cover the 2.5 spread. So that's, and on the other side of that, if you wager someone the underdog at +2.5, like say he's playing Nadal or Roger Federer or whoever, if they're +2.5, then if they just win one set. Then even if they lose the match, they can only have lost by two. So they would have covered, so to speak, right, John? And so they'd be on the positive end of the set spread. Any comments on set spreads, John?
Yeah, well, you've laid it out perfectly, Matt. There's like, how long's a piece of string? They've got lots of different props in tennis. But the fundamentals are the two you've mentioned. Simple, or the three if you count over-under, right? You're either winning the match, you're winning versus the spread. And tennis is a good spread sport because there's enough standard deviation between the games that are needed to win, especially at Wimbledon, which offers the five-set match, as you've mentioned. Not all tournaments are like that. A lot of the times they're just three-set matches in the non-majors, if you will, in tennis. And so there's lots of room. You got to win. Simply, you got to win six games in a set to win. So you can win 6-4, 6-4, 6-4, and be plus 5.5 and lose that bet. Right. So, or if you're laying 5.5, you're winning 6-4, 6-4, 6-4. You win, and there's lots of room for that kind of thing. So, set spread betting is very popular, and just if you need action, and this is what we've talked about 100 times, Matt, entertainment about in during the tennis tournaments and watching these tennis tournaments. There's nothing wrong with having a little bit of side action on it to watch it.
Absolutely. And so, so to keep going, so yep. set spread, as you just said, that's how we talked about how that works. And then it's kind of an overlap, but different in betting game spread. So the total number, so you said if you win 6-4, 6-4, 6-4, then obviously the differential in the aggregate is 6 in that case. It's not the best example. 6-3, 6-3, 6-3, the aggregate difference would be 9, right? Because mm-hmm. you won each set by 3. So if you had a total bet game spread of 8, and you win 9, then you're good. And if you're under, then you're on the other side of that equation. But so set spread, the number of sets won in a match versus betting game spread, the number or the differential on games won in a match. So, and then the other one, as you touched on, also the totals. So the number of games the number of games played in a match. So if there's someone who's a super heavy favorite and they might close someone out in 6-0 straight sets, then the total number of games would be 18. So if the over-under was set at 22.5 or something, then obviously you would have hit on the under. So whereas if it's going to be close and 6-5, we're going to talk about the FAA and Shapovalov matches, which are underway right now, but they're closely contested. So if it's 6-5, that's 11 games in one set, obviously. And so if at the end of two sets, you might be close to that 22.5 number. So, and then the final one we also touched on was props. So for some of these big events and the majors like Wimbledon, you can have all kinds of props. Something simple for someone like me would be the number of aces served by a certain player or combined between the two players, or another one that's often available is who's going to win the first set, etc., and lots of other options. So, and then the last one worth mentioning that I found interesting, to me anyway, was, of course, your favorite, John, you can always do live in-match betting. So if someone, after the match starts and there's a couple points earned, the odds are going to move in a certain direction. And how many times have we seen it where one player will start slow and maybe even lose the first two sets, maybe classic Jimmy Connors and Bjorn Borg match back in the day, Arthur Ashe, and someone's rallying from behind and the momentum swings, and for whatever reason, whatever technical reason or otherwise, just momentum and mood and pace and whatever else and fitness and all kinds of factors, right, John? But a trend can certainly reverse, and that's where you can really step in if you're an astute fan on top of things and knowing how to take advantage of that swing and momentum, right?
That's it. No, that's wonderfully laid out, Matt. Those are the fundamentals. And to me, I mean, they seem very, very, very intuitive to me, right? People get it, right? Yeah, you win the match. There's a bet there. There's a number of games to beat an opponent. Yeah, people get that. Total number. People know hockey and basketball and football. They'll know tennis. They know props, the individual. Aces was a good one. Do you have a big server? There's lots of data out there. Do you have a big server? Is he going to get 15 aces at Wimbledon? Yeah, 14.5. I'll go over, whatever. And, of course, in-game, Matt, is just magical in tennis. It's got enough data points, and the trading is very sharp on tennis. And this is one other thing. I'll try and boil it down to only a few number of factors, but tennis is very popular as a betting sport. And it's very interesting in North America because a lot of tennis is played at the higher levels and the lower levels in Europe and non-North American countries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's essentially a morning sport. So if you're sitting at work, okay, and you feel like you need to make a bet on something to get pass the time away, you can bet on tennis, right? It's happening right in front of you while it's going on.
Time difference, you mean? Because they're out there playing. It's still morning for us. Yeah.
So literally, the event started at 6 a.m. this morning. It might have been 5 a.m. 5 a.m. Eastern, of course, right? And which is what, 5 hours ahead Britain these days. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, that is a popular thing. And the operators, the sportsbook operators, even the American ones or the ones here in Ontario, they're pushing tennis as a thing to bet because everybody knows baseball and oftentimes baseball's in the afternoon and, of course, the nighttime sports and, of course, Sundays in the fall and Saturdays for college football and so on. We get that, right? That's what our hobby time is for. But for actual action, for people that are doing something during the morning or during the day, there is tennis to bet on. And the operators push it, and they offer good product to be able to do that kind of thing, to offer this sort of robust, especially live in-game, as you mentioned. Literally, Matt, point by point. And I've got one of the sports books in front of me here on the screen, and it's the odds are fluctuating like every few seconds. Plus 120, plus 150, 350 to plus 450, whatever, you know? And so I think that's important. The data's rich, and the operators view it as a legitimate, strong product that they can entice, especially popular in Europe and in Asia, but especially the newer markets in North America, newer consumer markets in North America.
All right, so let's get to this week, John. I know you've been thinking about it, and I'm guessing you may have even placed a wager. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but yeah. We talked about Shapovalov and FIA, the two big Canadian stars on the male side of the draw anyway, and of course, Bianca Andreescu on the female side. I see that the two Canadians are struggling. They're down two sets to one. Shapovalov lost 7-6, 7-6, sets 2 and 3. So hopefully they can rally, and I'm sure the odds are moving on those. Any thoughts on them or the balance of the draw, John?
I'm surprised that FAA is taking as much attention. Like, he's a good player, and he's going to be a really serious player for years to come. But he's not one of the favorites anymore. Like, he's still not one of the favorites. So to me, I'm starting to look at other guys in those markets. Now, Shapovalov is the same way. Like, he's a good player and is a good long shot player. But I mean, with her catch out, he lost. He was going to be one of the key players. And the other players that you said aren't even available to play in the tournament, Matt. And of course, the two COVID guys, and they're massive important players, right? Especially Berrettini. Berrettini was thought to be able to challenge Djokovic for a title. And the last part of this is that Djokovic isn't even in, he's not 2020, 2021 form. You know, he's what has he won? One tournament in all year? Like, it's not like he's the same player that he was. Alcaraz and Nadal are decidedly clay court players. Kyrgios, who is among the key players, he's a loose cannon, right? People actually, non-tennis fans even might know who he is because he's that l'enfant terrible, right? So what does that mean? You asked about the two Canadian players, and it's an unfortunate that they're down 2-1 now, but and they're both heavy favorites. So what do we do if we think they're going to bounce back, and their stats show like they might be able to bounce back? They are now legitimate underdogs to win. Now's the time to jump in and see if we can't get one of them home, because they've got the stats that look like they're playing better than being down 2-1. So to me, jump in there at a plus 200 at a Shapovalov and plus 150 for an FAA to jump back and win their specific matches.
Can I just interject? I saw Cressy was at, before the event, before this match started, Cressy was sitting at the board I looked at, 150-1 to win the event. Whereas FAA, as I said, had the third shortest odds behind Djokovic and Nadal. He was at 12-1. And now you're saying, because of the fact he's down 2-1, understandably, those odds have moved quite a bit. And now you can get FAA as a dog to win this match.
Yeah. Right? So, like, he's a good player that's got good stats for this particular match. Jump in there. Like, he's a terrible 20-1 ticket to win the tournament. But, you know, like, well, let's get him through this first thing. Get your plus 150 or something like that to win this match that he was verily heavy favored in it. Because he lost a tiebreaker. He's going to win the next tiebreaker and end up winning 6-2 in the final set or something like that because of the difference, the simple delta of the quality of play. So I think it's an important point in tennis is that you can have them bounce back if they're showing a reasonable form and they're, you know, the baseline stats are there, they'll bounce back. Especially when there's a delta and it comes to the quality of the players. So
what I was just going to ask on that point. So when we talk about bounces and trends and just sort of scratching the surface and having a hopefully more substantive basis for some of the decisions you make on when it comes to betting and not just superficial, like I think Nadal's headband looks cool today. And so what are some of the things that you to pop into your head as like things I want to consider before I go ahead and pull the trigger on something?
I think it's important. First thing is surface. Okay. It's very, very important. Surface, grass, clay, hard court, whatever. Okay. I think you have to understand that there are clay court specialists and there are grass court specialists. Mm-hmm. And grass court season is very, very short across the globe. You know, whatever, a month or so, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it is. So, but you know, Rafael Nadal is clearly one of the greatest players of all time, but he's won one Wimbledon. Okay, he's a clay court guy or a hard court guy. He just isn't as effective on grass.
Loves French Open, right?
Right. He's the man. He's won. I don't even know how many he's won. He's literally won double digits. Yeah. I think he's won 10 some crazy number. Mm-hmm. So you have to play against Nadal. Okay, now Nadal has a legitimate quality that he's probably going to get to the Final Four. But one of the plays then specifically on that concept is Alcaraz. Alcaraz has barely played on grass in his career. And he's essentially the second to third to fourth favorite on the board to win Wimbledon with all these sort of good players out like the Berrettinis and the Hurkaczes out. But to me, I'm going to try and play against him from here on out, maybe the third round on out, because he is not a grass court guy. He's a clay court guy, and there's a legitimate difference in the way the ball bounces. He barely played any grass prep, and he has even as a junior, he didn't even play that much grass. So, if you want to play against Alcaraz in the next couple of rounds, and you might get a fat +300, +400 on him to lose these particular matches because he's just not the kind of quality. So, surface is number one. Is surface, Matt?
Yeah, I want to get your rest of your list in a second, but can I just interject here quickly, John? Yep. So, need to remind myself and you, or not you, definitely not you, remind myself and people like me who are newer to this, you would say, well, the odds are here and those odds are based on someone who put that line in place knows the fact that someone's terrible on grass, mm-hmm. great on clay. This is a grass event. So I'm baking that into the odds that I'm putting here. Incorrect. That's not necessarily the case. The odds maker, the line setter, is focused on where money is being bet. And they see if a bunch of neophytes like me come lumbering in like, oh, I'm going to bet on some tennis for the first time. And I'm thinking, oh, he wins Wimbledon all the time. And Nadal's better on clay at the French Open. And so I'm going to make a bet on that basis. And then a bunch of us look at like world ranking and we say, this guy's a much higher ranked player. Let's bet on him. I think he's going to be good. And so it's our lack of sophistication, lack of understanding, lack of appreciation of the importance of different surfaces that may move a line in one direction or another. So it's the public or the squares versus the sharps who know what they're doing, the public who may influence where a line is set. So if you're on the other side of that equation and you actually understand or appreciate some of these nuances, that's where your value opportunity lays, and that's where you need to strike, right, John?
Bang on. I couldn't have said it better myself. You walk into the sports book, okay, I'm gonna take these tennis guys down. I say, Nadal, I'm gonna bet him. I've heard of him. He's gonna cream this guy at -150. Yeah,
and then smart dudes like you who are setting the line, they just sit there and watch. Okay, I got a bunch of meatheads on the one side who are putting the money down over here. so I better move the line that way or this way. And that's what they factor in. How is the public perceiving this? Where's the money coming in? That's what they place the line largely based on.
Hang on. They got to take action on both sides. Right. So they're shading it a certain way, and they may be shading it a little stronger to take more action on and again, Nadal's a little different than Alcaraz, but some of the clay court players. My sort of specific example is meant to reflect more Alcaraz in this context, because he just, to me, has absolutely got no turf. He was life and death to win one yesterday in the first round against similarly 150-1 type of player, Matt. And it's I missed who he's playing in the second round, but as soon as if this guy's got any kind of grass quality, you know, look out. I'm going to try and get my +400 against Alcaraz to try and take this guy down, and I'm eventually going to get paid. I can guarantee it. You know, yeah. So the more important thing is the action. The bookmakers are looking at this to say, yeah, you know, lots of people know who a Djokovic or a Nadal is or whomever in this particular tournament. They barely know what a Berrettini is. So, but they'll shade the lines for sure, and of players of an overall quality rather than a specific grass quality.
Okay, so that's great. Well said, John. And so other factors that you take a closer look at, in addition to the surface and some of the record in different tournaments and different events on different surfaces, what are some of the other things that you like to focus on?
Now, there's a statistic, Matt, that is very predictive, thought to be very predictive, and that's a winning percentage on serves and return of serve. Win points, okay, winning points percentage, okay, point percentage, to break it down simply, point percentage on serves and return of serves. Mm-hmm. If that is a number that's in the, if you put the percentages together, if that's in the, on the positive side, it usually ends up being 110 or something like that, and I'm talking about aggregating the two. So you'd win 60% of your, 60% of your serve percentage and 50% of your return of serve. That's 110. That's a really high quality player. So you look at those kinds of predictive stats and think, yeah, I kind of get that. You've got a big booming serve, but you also have enough skill to return booming serves.
For a point. Guys. So it's not winning the point when you serve. It's winning the point on your serve.
Nope.
Okay.
Winning the point, the former. It's winning the point.
So it's like holding serve sort of.
That's right.
Well, that's not the right, but it's the, yeah.
No, it's.
When you serve, you ultimately win the point when you're serving.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So when you're serving strong, you're putting your opponent in a jam, no matter what, when you're serving. You go wide and they hit it back. Fine, it's not an ace or a service winner, but they might hit it back weakly and then bam, you got an easy volley winner. Mm-hmm. On the return of serve side, if you got skill, Jimmy Connors is a good example. You know, was a great return of service player. He pounded the ball back there. He loved pace, and he pounds the ball back, and he put himself in a ground stroke situation where he would just go bat the ball back and forth with one of the guys. That's also a significant skill.
Okay, so this is new to me.
Yep.
I'm confused. So on every serve of every match, so I know you're right. I'm not arguing with you. I'm just trying to understand it in my head.
Of course, no,
so on every serve of every match, someone gets a point for, no, one of the two players is ascribed a point either for the return or for the serve, right?
Both.
It's impossible.
Right? Like, so
you don't get a point if you serve and you lose the point though.
Correct. But it's still a reaction on the percentage of what they have done on that particular set of points.
Oh, okay. Well, that's what I mean. So you don't score a point, but you fail. So you get a zero, and that factors into your percentage. Is what you're saying, right?
That's correct.
So, but someone, each player, there's one point ascribed either to the server or to the returner on each serve.
Yeah.
So
in other words, okay. So you got, let's say if you win half of the points against your serve. Let's start that over. If you win half your points returning serve, you are a very much an elite player. Mm-hmm. And that's predictive of your future value as a player, as a bet. Okay? Yeah. If you're winning 60% of your actual service, the points in your actual service games, that's an elite player.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Mm-hmm. So what does that add up to? 60 plus 50, 110. you know, I mean, the numbers are somewhere in the 115 range, something like that. 118. Those are the higher levels of competition that that some of these players are at. And if you're in the 100 range or 102 range or whatever, you're just simply not as good. So if you have a somebody that's facing another that's got 117 return serve and return serve percentage compared to somebody that's at 102, you've got a dramatic mismatch, and it better be reflected in the odds, or you're going to get killed by the customers.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
So, but that's an important consideration that. It's not only Alcaraz and Nadal win huge numbers. Those numbers are through the roof on clay. They're not so on grass, Matt. So mm-hmm. you have to factor in the surface as well. Mm-hmm. And the last point, and I'll be very brief on this one, and it's a fundamental one. And you know, you can't have five set matches day after day after day at Wimbledon. Okay,
without it affecting your performance, right?
Bang on, right? Yeah. You can't. You're empty, right? You've got to take some breaks. You've got to have some breaks. And if you're winning five set matches 3 days in a row, you know, it's hard to see you winning a fourth day in a row. You know, mm-hmm. that's the cliche. Mm-hmm. But everything sort of lines up, and it's all there's a number of other factors and so on. And if you're winning big return serve percentages and you know you love your grass and you barely play another day of the year and you're fit as a fiddle, maybe you can. But those are the things that I look at, and a lot of people look at in terms of their tennis handicapping, and that's what I'm looking at right now.
Great stuff. Okay, we're going to move on, John. Before we do, anything else you want to say about Wimbledon or this week? I just on my computer here in front of me, I'm seeing FAA is now down 4-3 in the fourth, down 2-1, so he could be closed out with just 2 more games. Oh, no. Shapovalov also down 2-1, and in the fourth set, he's still at 2-2. Not looking good for FAA, but hopefully can bounce back, and the odds are moving in his favor, as you said. But what else on Wimbledon, John?
Yeah, there's both small dogs, though, Matt. They expect people, the traders think they're going to bounce back.
Nice.
This is weird, eh? So it'll be interesting to see. We'll find out the next time we're on to see how well they've actually did, and considering that they're both two sets down, a set down, and in the deep parts of the fourth set. Will they hang on? I don't know. Or will they bounce back, rather? I don't know. No, the only play I've made, I liked Berrettini quite a bit. Mm. I actually made a bet on Cilic to win that first quarter. So at least they didn't start playing, and should get a refund on those bets. But the only significant bet, I actually bet Bianca Andreescu to win her quarter. Mm-hmm. So I really like the way she's in form. She played well in the previous grass tournament, and she's obviously got championship medal. She won the U.S. Open there a couple years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so she's the only substantial one, and it's truly not just being yay Canada. It's not that. She's got good numbers, and I mean, I'm too much of a chicken to bet against Swiatek, who is the heavy, heavy favorite to win the women's draw. She's not a substantial grass court player, and you know she hasn't really been playing that much grass in the past. So before Wimbledon, I think she goes down. I think somebody beats her. And there's a bet out there that says, I don't know, plus 150 or something like that. Minus 150 for her to. For her to not win. So you can have everybody else in the field, and you can get against her that she won't end up being the tournament winner. And I mean, that seems like a good bet to me.
All right. So a lot of moving pieces there. It's happening in real time. We're recording this at just before 3 p.m. Eastern on a Tuesday. So maybe by the time we sign off today, we'll have some more update on that. But a lot of Canadian superstar tennis players in action at Wimbledon as we're recording. Let's keep going, John. We're running up against time, so we might do a shorter run through on the MLB and the NBA free agency window opening. So on MLB, any comments here, John? We just talked about the Yankees. We've kind of lamented the salary cap situation before. I'm looking at the best odds available at VegasInsider.com. I see the Yankees, you can still get them at plus 450. I'm guessing you don't see that as a lot of value, John. No. Dodgers, same numbers, essentially. Third, the Astros, then the Mets. And then sitting right behind, depending on how you look at it, not bad. Fifth shortest odds are the Blue Jays. Their best number that I see here on an odds comparator, as I mentioned, is plus 1,200. Looking forward, though, into some of the moving pieces, I touched on the fact that if you're pursuing a free agent, you are, and you're in the American League East, you're probably, if you acquire someone, you're preventing them from going to the Yankees or to the Red Sox or what have you. So it's sort of a double-edged sword in that respect. The acquisition of Sergio Romo, John, could you be more underwhelmed, do you think? DFA'd, what's that?
I couldn't be more underwhelmed.
Yeah. DFA'd by the Mariners after he put up an ERA of 8.36 earlier this season, and we're going to go out and acquire him. I sent a tweet last night from Matt at SXM Prime, follow me on Twitter, but I said, more Shatkins trying to capture lightning in a bottle, as you coined the phrase, or as you described it, and I'm just growing very weak and tired. And so pointed out that they acquired, the Blue Jays acquired Simber and Richards. Richards, of course, now on the IL, unfortunately, after struggling, and now he's got a neck issue. But they acquired the two of them, who pitched great last year and were good in the early part of this year, right around this time last year, so in mid-June last year. So we also hear, as I alluded to earlier, the Jays are in on discussions with respect to Luis Castillo of the Reds, who is incredibly strong pitcher for the Reds, with a team looking to get rid of a salary where they can. He's only making 7.3 this year, has another season before arbitration, doesn't reach free agency until 2024. Sounds a lot like the position Jose Barrios was in when the Blue Jays acquired him, and they, for Simeon Woods Richardson and Austin Martin. Of course, Barrios struggling a little bit now, but hopefully he'll turn it around. I still have faith in him. I think you do too, John. Mm-hmm. Similar stats, similar contract situation. Obviously, the Jays should pounce if they can. There's not a huge financial commitment there. And in the championship window, and it's limited duration, and the Jays have been holding back for 20-plus years, it's time to start rolling the dice on some of these players. And the fans will be there, and they have the resources to do so. And you just can't compete in that league or in that division without being bold on some of these things. Last thing before I flip to you, John, I just want to mention some of the current. Let's enjoy the incredible season that is Captain Kirk, Alejandro Kirk. We were talking back about when he was just a 5'8", 250-pound nobody, but now he is. Let's just enjoy this, John. He's fifth in the American League in batting average. He's second in on-base percentage. Luis Arraez of the Twins is the only one we saw him play, John. Mm-hmm. Second in the American League in on-base percentage. Is that mind-blowing? Or?
Yeah.
Sixth in OPS. Vladdy's 10th, by the way. Just aren't these just the most mind-blowing stats you can remember in recent Jays history? He's got a 3.4 WAR, John, which ranks fifth in the American League amongst position players.
Like, here's Manny Machado is only like, what, 0.75 higher?
Yeah. So, but here's the list for the American League. So he's fifth in the American League. Here's who's ahead of him.
Okay.
Mike Trout, Rafi Devers, Aaron Judge, and Kyle Tucker.
Amazing.
That's who's ahead of Alejandro Kirk at this point in the season, almost July. He's tied with Yordan Alvarez and Joe Ram of the Guards. He's first for catchers by a wide margin. The Blue Jays, between him and Moreno and Jansen, who's almost back, they are leading in every statistical category for catchers, offensive and defense in the majors currently. Who saw that coming? You know, and a little bit of an underperformance by some of the other guys on the team, but you know, you see Bo's having a tough time. His average is up 40 points or something. He's still eighth in the league in hits. Vladdy's still in the top 10 in OPS, so he's not putting up the numbers he was last year, but he's been coming out of it recently. Still feeling relatively strong, but I guess to conclude, John, my point is, with the moves in the right direction and the wrong direction and some of the surprises and some of the letdowns, the Jays are still in a position to be very aggressive heading into the, I don't want to say trade deadline, but the period ahead of the trade deadline. And we all know that the Yankees have an historically strong team this year and have absolutely stretched themselves to a ridiculous degree, even for them, on payroll and the money they're spending on their position players in particular. So Jay's sitting in a playoff spot currently, need to get stronger, particularly on the pitching side. Let's face it, they can't squander another year like they did last year. And in my view, that's exactly what they did by making some horrible acquisitions down the stretch that didn't work out. And they squandered one of the best offensive seasons cumulatively for that team in franchise history. And they threw it away because they weren't willing to be aggressive enough financially in acquiring a couple more fundamental pieces towards the trade deadline. So tell me that's not going to happen again this year, please, John. We're going to be a little smarter about being aggressive on some of these things.
Right. And the only thing is the purchase price for some of these guys. Do we really want Luis Castillo, Matt? Like, this is obviously rhetorical. Like, he's going to be a hot prospect over the next month. Okay. How about Frankie Montas? Okay. How about Martin Perez? Those seem to be some sort of important starting pitchers. We haven't even got to the lineup questions yet, but those are the three starting pitchers, let's just say, are the most popular ones that are out there. Are you ready to give up Gabriel Moreno for any of them? Right? So, again, it's rhetorical, Matt. I'm not asking specifically, but like the Yankees are going to be after Luis Castillo as well. And the Dodgers. And you know those things that you've been very, very sharp on. You know, these guys have got all kinds of money. But that's what's going to cost.
Yeah, there's a couple untouchables, but other than them, but who are the untouchables? There's two or three, and that's it. So that's what I would say to that. But I agree with you. So, but what do you think? Or say, talk about whatever you want, but I guess just remind the main thing. Do you think they're going to do that, though? Are they going to be aggressive beyond those couple of untouchables, or are they going to just...
How can they not be? This is the window. The window is here. The window is here. There's not many more years. And how many Ryu contracts or Kikuchi contracts are we gonna burn? You know, kind exactly. of thing on that route. Yeah. So there's gonna be a couple of hits, and Gausman has been a hit so far, I guess. Right? I guess he has obviously been very good.
Yeah.
But there's a good opportunity there. Well, let's keep trying. Let's keep getting it to the point where, you know, they got rid of, do you know who they got rid of for Jose Berríos last year, man? How many times did we talk about it? Literally two of the top five prospects in the whole organization. Mm-hmm. That's what it's going to cost. Mm-hmm. And they better go for it because it's got to be in the starting pitching. And if they want little pieces here and there in the bullpen, I get that too. But if we trust this team, this starting rotation to go far, to take this team far, fine. I'm willing to listen. But to me, it needs starting pitching, and I think they've got the assets and the cash to get there.
That is the front office for the Cincinnati Reds calling, John. They want to know if...
sorry about that.
It's all right. These things happen. And so, no, but that's exactly it. And so Shapiro, Atkins, Charlie Montoya, all three of them are finished at the end of this year. Front office is fired at the end of this year, and Montoya's gone before the end of the year if the Jays fall out of a playoff position. And I'd say even if they get swept or taken out in two games or whatever the playoff format is this year, then that's not going to be enough either. They're going to be gone as well. They've had their run, and they're underperforming, and we can't keep squandering year after year of these supremely talented young players while we have the control contractually, and their years of service is ticking every time we flush down another Jake Lamb acquisition or Sergio Romo. Like, what are we doing?
Brad,
what is the point of this? Yeah.
So, yeah, I think they will. Like, if you're asking for opinions, I think they're going to. They have shown that kind of, they've shown that kind of desire to. Whether they've been all that successful, obviously they haven't.
But, who are the managers that have been fired already this year? Right, so Girardi, and who's the other big one? The other. Anyway, it'll come back to me. But like, with the Angels. Cubs manager
Madden.
Yeah. So the two of them. How short was the trigger pull on them, John? Mm-hmm. How quick was it? I'm mixing metaphors, but you know what I mean. The fuse was short on those guys. The trigger was pulled quickly. Am I overstating it by saying they had a much shorter rope than has been afforded to Charlie Montoya in Toronto? Would you say they're fundamentally different in approach organizationally? Or is it, could you...
They want to win, right? Do the Blue Jays want to win? So you got to have somebody at the helm to do that. So,
and I love Charlie Montoya on a personal level. He's a great guy. I think he's an awesome guy, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm talking about baseball and winning in baseball, and whether it's working and whether the message is getting through and guys are motivated and in the right headspace and performing optimally, and whether it's Pete Walker with the pitching staff. And I'm tired of people sort of shoving these success stories into the spotlight and then trying to use their vertical integration media empire to discount or downplay the focus on all of these failures, a few of which you already referenced. And they're piling up on the wrong side of the ledger. Sure, they struck gold on a couple of them, but there's a lot more failures than there are successes. And if we're scrutinizing these things a little more closely, I think that's a positive thing for the organization and a positive thing for the likelihood of this team succeeding. So we wanted to focus on the futures, though, John. Do you think the Jays are still a value at plus 1,200? You got the Braves sitting behind them at plus 1,300, the Padres, the Brewers, any of those seem like value for betting? How about the Rays at plus 3,000, John?
No, I told you my plan. If I didn't tell it on air, I played the White Sox the other day, you know, and mm-hmm. I just think, of course, they're like two of seven or something, 2 of 8. Oh yeah, the Jays series. That's what I bet them during that series. Mm-hmm. I mean, so no, I took my shot at a value, and it's not going very well. So talking about my own sort of perspective, like, that's the kind of team I want to see. And you struck me when you said Montoya is a question mark. It's time to get rid of him. Like, when is it that the White Sox are going to get rid of that relic? You know, like, and it's...
You really hate him.
Well, I think he's a terrible manager. I think he was good when you have, you know, Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco in literally peak form.
Okay. Tony La Russa, yeah.
Dennis Eckersley, the Hall of Famers, Hall of Famers. Yeah. Okay, you can be sort of swashbuckling and act a certain way, but he's not this team.
Carney Lansford and right. Dave Parker, the
Name
Cobra.
Name them all, Matt. Naming them all. It's just there were legends. Yeah. Get rid of this guy. And this is my own personal thing, and it just struck me when you said Montoya. Like, when are they going to get rid of? They got rid of Joe Maddon. They got rid of Joe Girardi. Look at those teams sort of, you know, improve themselves. Time to get rid of Tony La Russa for my own purposes. Get in somebody else that might right. fire him, because the talent's there and they're not that far out.
Right. So Phillies turned it around until Bryce Harper got hit on the hand. Yeah. But yeah, you know, these things work sometimes. And yeah, well, you know what, John? I'm not trying to be contrarian here, but I like that White Sox bet. You know what I mean? Like, they've had some injuries.
Giolito, yeah.
What's that?
Hang on to it then.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Yeah. Looks good to me. Giolito is not getting it done, but they still have a ridiculous, you know, with Lance Lynn and Dylan Cease and favorable home cooking, umpiring aside, they look like they're favorably positioned in there. Okay, anything else on MLB futures, John? The Yankees haven't won since 2009. Telling me they're not blowing their brains out to acquire everyone they can. If you're shoving all your chips in, or whatever metaphor you want to use or expression you want to use, they've stretched themselves so far already. What's a little more? They don't care. It's just funny money to them anyway, right?
They're going to, Matt. They're going to.
That's my
and
point.
It's going to start tonight. I'll tell you what's going to happen. They're going to see Frankie Montas up and close right now, tonight. They're where are they, home? I assume they're home. Yeah, they're home. The Yankees aren't home. Frankie Montas is on the hill. If Frankie Montas pitches well tonight, I can guarantee you he's going to be picked up by the Yankees over the next month.
Oh man!
You know, so no. This is it. They. You know, this is all. It's all done until next year. They'll worry about Judge and his $40 million he's going to get, whatever he's going to get. Right? He's going to get monster contract and just win, because then they'll have the money. The pressure will be off. It won't matter. Right? They always had the money, but I think they're going for it, man. I think they made a bad decision about acquiring or signing Judge or re-upping Judge, but maybe that's the motivation the guy needed, right? The guy's killing it. He's obviously going to be, he's the leading candidate for most home runs and MVP, et cetera. And if he still continues to do it, if they stay healthy, how they'll just acquire players to beef up their team. So watch tonight. It'll be interesting to see how Montas pitched tonight. If he pitches well, he'll be a Yankee in a week or two.
Oh, man. Not happy to hear it, but you're probably right. So I do like the Jays tonight against Waka and the Red Sox, hopefully to take that second game. Waka is sort of looking at an article on Fantagraphs earlier today. His results sort of outperforms the quality, his BABIP results and so on. So he's had a little good fortune there, and there's a prediction, or there's some predictive analytics you can look at that he will most likely revert to a mean, which is more reflective of his actual performance. That's quite a mouthful off the top of my head.
No, accurate. But no, people understand that. That's accurate. So, bang on.
So we'll see, and hopefully some of the hotter hitting for the Jays can continue. I'm trying to find on my screen here, I'm remind myself who's pitching tonight. Is it Manoah?
It's Stripling.
Stripling. Okay, yeah. Well, I like that. And as I say, Waka is due for a bad outing. So let's hope for the best there. All right, let's keep going. We wanted to take a quick look, John, at some of the NBA futures in view of the craziness that will be free agency. Kyrie announced he's exercising his player option to return to the Nets. How about this? Let me hit you with this, John. Mm. I had to refresh my memory. Okay, so we got KD, arguably the best player in the world. Kyrie, love him, hate him, you know, all the craziness with vaccine and so on. his numbers are still really off the chart, like historically good in terms of effectiveness, shooting percentage, when he's good, when he's motivated, when he wants to play with his incense and having his snacks and sun goes down fasting and all that crap. But when he laces him up and gives it what gives it his all, he's still an unbelievably efficient, effective player, historically so. So it's hard, it's easy to forget how good he is. Anyway, so KD, Kyrie, obviously Ben Simmons. What a circus this team's going to be, John. Ben Simmons. Joe Harris is going to be back, right? Healthy. Nick Claxton, underutilized to me. I like that kid. And then you still got Seth Curry and Andre Drummond, I believe, unless they, I think they're still there. Yeah. So how's that? KD, Kyrie, Ben Simmons, so who's all NBA 2 years ago, Joe Harris, Nick Claxton, Seth Curry, Andre Drummond. There's your top eight. You know, like, tell me that's not a powerhouse in the East. Get your comments on that. Clippers, of course, the news, the other big news yesterday was John Wall coming out of the dustbin to join the Clippers. Good heavens. Kawhi Leonard, you know, seeing video of him playing and he's healthy again coming off. I think it was the ACL, John. And, of course, Paul George reportedly healthy. And then you got Reggie Jackson, you got Norm Powell and Zoo and the rest of those guys in there. So Clippers are looking unbelievably stacked if they can just stay healthy. Of course, that's always the question with these big super teams with older free agents, right? Whether it's the Clippers or the Nets or the Lakers or what have you. So, and then, of course, don't overlook when we're looking at NBA futures. You talk about the Nets and the Clippers. How about the defending champs? You know, like, it's, you can't forget them, right? And by the way, they're adding James Wiseman into the fold this year. So, sure, they're getting older, but also getting stronger. So, a lot of interesting things in play, John. We're looking at the numbers in terms of futures before we review some of that. What do you think of all the craziness, and what do you see as some of the big stories? We touched on DeAndre Ayton in the opener, but it opens up this weekend, I think, the free agent window in the NBA.
I'll tell you this. I liked a lot of what you said, but I cringe when you started talking up the Nets. Okay, rhetorically or actually, Matt, here's a question. They're similar priced. Who's going to win? Who's going to win the NBA championship? The Brooklyn Nets or the LA Clippers? Right. So let's just view it as rhetorically for a second. Okay. Saying how is it with that circus, the Nets? You know, like that they're going to win the NBA championship. Yeah. It's just as bad as what it was in the latter part of the regular season last year. No way they're going to take any of my money. The Clippers, I'll grant, especially they might acquire a couple of players here and there and a healthy Kawhi, and you mentioned Paul George, et cetera, okay? And the Warriors, your point, you told me something off air that I liked more. How about your long shot pick for this for the NBA championship? That's the one I want to be a part of. The New Orleans Pelicans.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about championship, but yes, I said the challenge in the West for sure. If I saw a picture of Zion, I was like, is that Photoshopped? Like he looks so healthy and so fit. Yeah. I was like, who is that? So can you, I just love to see that for him. He was an exciting player when he was healthy.
50-1 to win the MVP. How about that? That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah. That, like, is, that's value. Yeah.
Seriously. You want LeBron James at 22-1? Like, what hell? Hello. I'll take a flyer on somebody like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, just think, who else is 50-1, Matt? Jimmy Butler. Okay. So this market, they're viewing this guy at the same level as a Jimmy Butler. And he didn't play last year. And he's fit. And he's got an improving team. Matt, who did they lose to? They lost to Phoenix, right? They lost, I think it was, might have been six games, I think it was. But, I mean, the Zion plays, you never know. And to me, that's the kind of, I stole your segment a little bit, Matt, but I'm viewing it through this lens, saying, like, who do we want to bet on going forward? We got to look at those sort of first round losers, second round losers that are having step function changes to their roster, like the Clippers you mentioned. Okay, how about the Pelicans at a big fat number? How about Zion at 50, similar type 50-1? I mean, let me just double check what the Pels are, 40-1, or Zion at 50-1. To me, a healthy Zion that plays his entire season, okay, is more likely to win the MVP than the Pelicans at 40-1 to win the NBA championship. Mm-hmm. So to me, that's that. And you talk about his fitness. I love that play.
Yeah. So the Celtics are the second shortest odds on the where I'm looking on bettingpros.com. So they're at, not surprisingly, the finalists. They're at plus 600. Bucks sitting there in third shortest odds. Kind of a surprise to me, ahead of the Nets. But the Nets quickly moving back up into the fourth position in terms of the lines that are available. followed by the Clippers, Suns, and Mavs. But yeah, a lot of moving pieces. Any big surprises you're expecting or anything that you're in particular focused on as the free agent window opens up at the end of the weekend, John?
Not particularly. It's already started with the Kyrie stuff. I remember last pod or two pods ago when you said, oh yeah, how about the Knicks sending Julius Randle? And I thought, oh my God, you're going to say Kyrie's going to the Knicks. There's always that chaos, and that doesn't mean that he's not going to go to the Lakers or somewhere else. Did you see that? Was it this morning, Matt? Westbrook has took up his player option with the Lakers. Yeah. So there's $47 million the Lakers are going to soak. Now, how about sending Kyrie out there with a few other? I guess they don't have enough assets, the Lakers, anyways. But I don't have a view on that. I've been too engrossed in the Kyrie situation. I thought he actually was going to go to the Lakers, and he still may. The rookie of the year markets are fascinating, and those top three guys are the three favorites. But remember, Scotty was 12, 15 to 1 at the beginning about this time last year? Like, there's value to be had in those markets, and we'll watch those as the summer goes.
Outside the top three, extolling the virtues of Shaden Sharp from London, Ontario, I've been hammering that drum. So, yeah.
He's 12 to 1, Matt. You can get him at 12 to 1. That's the perfect type player. Matherin, pardon me. I butchered every time. It's also 12 to 1, by the way. Although I didn't like him calling out LeBron. But anyways, that's
yeah, funny. That's funny. All right, we covered the waterfront. A lot to talk about, and we can revisit these issues going forward. We're done for now. Thanks, John. Remember, everyone, to bet responsibly. Remember to have fun. That's what the whole point of this is. We're back at you later in the week, and we'll see how... can we do a quick check on the tennis, yes, John? Let's see. I'm afraid to look.
Yeah, Shapovalov won set four, so...
Oh, good. He's hanging in there. How about FAA?
FAA is... he's down. Ooh, it's 4-3 in the tiebreaker, in the third set tiebreaker. If he loses, that's it. It's over.
They're in the tiebreaker in the fourth set.
Pardon me, in the fourth set. Sorry. Saying that over, it's like in the fourth set. They're in the fourth set tiebreaker. It's 4-4 in the fourth set tiebreaker. So if he loses, that means it's all over for FAA in this fortnight.
Ay, ay, ay.
Shapovalov is he's they're 2-2 as I mentioned, and he's about to go up 2-1 in set five. So and he's a big heavy favorite, but FAA is only a small dog still. They expect him to win this tiebreaker. And at +62, +162 for a guy that was -300, you know, like, I don't know. There's value in tennis, guys. It's a wonderful betting sport. Keep your eyes peeled.
All right. The more you learn, the more you focus on it, the more fun it can be. So let's leave it at that. Thanks, John, and great job today. And we'll talk to you later in the week. Peace. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and is not intended to constitute gambling advice. Views and opinions expressed are solely those of the commentators and do not reflect the views of SiriusXM or its affiliates, nor do those views or opinions guarantee or increase the likelihood of any outcome. If you choose to engage in any gambling activity, you do so at your own risk.